This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Being a Wild Thing. Being a wild thing. Because sometimes it's worth it to yell, "I'll eat you up!" at someone, no matter how much trouble you get in afterward. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is about the 60th birthday of Where the Wild Things Are. This is the 99th episode of the show. That means that next week, co-host Chloe will join me to celebrate by answering questions from you, the listeners. It's crazy that the show is still going this strong, and I have so many more ideas for the future. I'm currently working on my plan for next year. So if there's books or stories that you would like us to talk about on the show, please let me know. Send a message to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I've also got a new video up on my YouTube channel that explains what pitch is and how Karana used it in Island of the Blue Dolphins to make her canoe watertight. When I started the channel, I thought I'd only use it occasionally to put up videos that would be useful to parents and teachers when teaching about various works of literature. I want to keep making videos like that. But I've also discovered that there are various topics that would be fun to discuss over there because they don't quite fit in the format of my weekly podcast, but they do relate to current topics in children's literature and would benefit from being done on video. Please check out my YouTube channel with the name Children's Literature Podcast and subscribe if you don't want to miss any of the upcoming fun. I really would like the podcasts and videos I make to be helpful to as many people as possible, so if you can spread the word about the show, I'd be really grateful. The audience has really grown over the last year, and doing little things like subscribing to the YouTube channel, leaving a like on videos you've found helpful, or leaving a rating for the podcast will help others see what I'm up to. Where the Wild Things Are by Mari Sendak is turning 60 years old next week. I first read it when I was 4 or 5 years old. I kept checking it out from the library over and over again until my parents finally bought me a copy. Many picture books that are childhood favorites only get remembered in adulthood when people have children of their own. Where the Wild Things Are is a rare masterpiece that I never stopped loving, and I've only come to appreciate it more the older I get. It's a story that millions of people have read and loved, and yet, when it first came out in November 1963, it caused a little controversy. The early 1960s ushered in the beginnings of the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, and literary exploration of ideas from the rapidly accelerating fields of psychology and physical science. These social and artistic changes affected children's books as much as those written for adults. Children's books before this time were relatively gentle, offering color and humor, but certainly not endorsing rebelliousness or allowing scary or strange themes into the texts. Amelia Bedelia, which was published the same year as Where the Wild Things Are, is one of these fairly mainstream books. It's colorful and funny and totally enjoyable. It's also not controversial, because it's just a sweet, funny story about a woman who takes figures of speech a little too literally. But also in 1963, there were stories like A Wrinkle in Time, which explored the concept of interdimensional travel, and Stig of the Dump, which could be interpreted either as a work of psychological fiction, science fiction, or time travel, depending on how you interpret a little boy seeing a cave boy in his 20th century neighborhood. The book that caused the biggest stir was The Gashly Crumb Tinies by Edward Gorey. It's a hilariously morbid book that goes through the alphabet with the names of children who die in various awful ways. These books all pushed the boundaries of what children's literature was supposed to be. They didn't teach children anything about how to behave or preach any particular brand of morality. They were strange and sometimes a bit scary. So when The Wild Things Are was published, many parents and teachers decided this book had simply gone too far. As an illustrated book, it could be read to very little children. And it was weird and scary. It had monsters. And it had a main character who behaved badly and didn't even seem to be sorry about it. and kids loved it. I have tried, and I have failed, to think of a protagonist in a children's book published before Where the Wild Things Are that's quite like Max. In all previous books I could think of, there were children who were badly behaved, but it was always clear that they were the bad guys in the story, or they existed in the plot to be reformed into penitent little angels. In Anne of Green Gables and its sequels, Josie Pye remained an unpleasant antagonist that the reader was not supposed to like or identify with. In The Chronicles of Narnia, Eustace Scrubb goes from being a self-righteous irritation to a valiant, morality-driven hero. But I can't think of a character before Max who's just kind of an unapologetic little brat for the duration of the story. And I think that's a huge part of why the book is so loved. Sometimes kids have a bad night. Metaphorically or literally, we've all put on our wolf suits and made mischief of one kind or another. We got in trouble for it, but in the end, we knew that the loved ones we'd annoyed still loved us, even if things hadn't been completely put right. This is a very small but very important story arc for Max, because it's a reality that kids live quite often. Some kids live it multiple times a day. Just in the first picture of the book, there is ample evidence of Max's misdeeds. He's stolen a bunch of handkerchiefs or napkins and firmly knotted them together. Have fun picking those apart without damaging them, Mom. He's stolen a chair and a bedsheet to make a tent, and hung a poor little teddy bear by its arm. He's standing on large, probably expensive books, and, most shocking to my childhood self, he is driving a huge nail into the wall with a hammer that he is probably not allowed to use. He's already messed up the plaster on the wall, and it would appear he's going to keep right on going. Max is sent to his room, which is supposed to be a punishment, but he refuses to cooperate there as well. He doesn't just sit down on his bed and have a think about what he's done. He just moves his mischief-making into his imagination, where he weaves a fantasy for himself about running away from home to be king of the wild things. And he has a great time. But then he starts to get hungry, and he wants to be, quote, where someone loved him best of all, end quote. Notice that he isn't motivated by the love he feels for that someone, his mother. Max's feelings are the limited, egocentric, selfish kind that is completely normal for a child. He's not old enough or mature enough to understand how to give back love. He's still at that stage of life where children expect, no, demand, love and attention. He has no ability to understand how exhausting and frustrating those demands can be at times. Where the Wild Things Are doesn't challenge this, or try to educate children about how they need to be less selfish, or even comment on the morality of Max's mindset and behavior. Thankfully, Mari Sendak was way too smart to do that in a book like this. Where the Wild Things Are would have been insufferably tedious if halfway through the book, one of the wild things had started to give him a lecture about how he needed to show a little more gratitude for everything his mother did for him. And then, after a moment of enlightenment, he rushed back home and gave a little speech about how he'd learned to be a good boy at last. No. Max has a horrible night where he acts like an entitled, destructive little brat. His mom sends him to his room because she just can't even deal with him for one more moment. But she still feeds him anyway because, despite it all, she loves her son. This is where the story speaks to adults as much as it does to children. All of you adults listening, every single one of you, more than once drove your parents and other caregivers up the wall. You were rude. You were bratty. You broke something and lied about it. And you got in trouble for it. Those adults put up with your nonsense. And now you have to put up with your kids' nonsense. It's the circle of life, people. Kids and adults are able to look at Max and say, I know that kid, because he's me sometimes. And that's why we love this book. The story is so strong that even without the pictures, we'd probably still be drawn to it. But it's the illustrations that make this book an undisputed classic. The art style Sendak used was very different from the minimalist style that had dominated in the 1950s with its clean lines and pure colors. The best word to describe the pictures and where the wild things are is textured. Absolutely every part of every illustration is layered with lines, cross-hatching, and modeling of multiple colors. There's something to look at everywhere. Unnatural shades of pink, burgundy, and yellowish-green are used for the plants, giving them a dreamlike quality. Each of the wild things is made up of a chaotic mix of animal and human parts. Duck feet, human feet, lion's manes, coats striped to look like knitted sweaters, lumpy scales mixed with long ponytails. If you've got a copy of the book, go get it and open it up. You'll see how Sendak used his drawings to express how Max feels. The first pictures, in which Max is running around his house destroying the walls and chasing the dog with a fork, are smaller than the actual page, with more than an inch and a half of plain white padding around them. He's physically boxed in by his environment. But when Max is sent to his room, those boundaries are shoved back a little bit. The picture grows larger, and that plain white box shrinks to about an inch and a quarter. In the next picture, when Max begins imagining the forest, the leaves of the trees are beginning to erase that hard boundary altogether. The square, straight, rigid, defined lines of Max's house vanish and give way to a world where there are no straight lines at all, just an endless realm of oceans and jungles and wild things and all-night rumpuses. When Max finishes his daydream, he comes back to his bedroom, but you'll notice that the image still goes all the way to the edge of the paper. The picture is no longer boxed in, because Max doesn't feel boxed in anymore. He's worked out his wild energy, and he's ready to calm down. He's beginning to take off his wolf suit and is happily looking forward to having his supper, even if it is to be eaten alone in his room. The pictures remind me a lot of medieval art styles, with fantastic beasts made up of strange combinations of parts and crowd scenes in stiff but still beautiful formations. The way the figures are presented in horizontal lines facing the same direction look a lot like the way groups of people were painted in illuminated manuscripts. During the wild rumpus, Max is raised up in a procession in which he carries a very medieval-looking scepter and wears a tall, pointed, fur-lined crown. This all harkens back to an earlier time, a less modern time, a wilder time. When I was flipping through the book to prepare for this episode, I saw something that I'd never noticed before. At the beginning of the story, the moon is in the phase called waxing crescent. That's when there's a sliver of moon on the left side as it grows from a new moon toward a full moon. As soon as Max is declared king of all wild things, the moon is suddenly full, and it stays full until the end of the story, even when Max comes back home again. This would imply that he was gone for at least a few weeks. Or is this just meant to suggest what it felt like to Max, as in time flies when you're having fun? Maurice Sendak would not have messed up the image of the moon on accident. His illustrations are too carefully composed. They're surreal and detailed and meant to get inside our heads. Max has no problem blending the worlds of fantasy and reality, and it seems Sendak is happy to do the same thing. Where the Wild Things Are is turning 60 this week, and it's showing no signs of its age. I loved this book as a kid. I love it now, and I love that my kids love it. I'm hoping that you'll join me in celebrating the birthday of this truly wonderful book by either dressing up as a wild thing or drawing a picture of one. You can share it online with the hashtag #HappyBirthdayWildThings. Come and find me over on Instagram or Facebook at Children's Literature Podcast. Make sure you tag me so I can see and share your work. We are all wild things once in a while. If Max were real, he'd be an old man now, but I want to believe that, like the author who created him, he'd never be fully tamed. And I hope that's true for the rest of us as well. Happy birthday, Where the Wild Things Are, and here's to many more. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.